All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Free For All, streaming live on this Thursday night right here at Grumblings Media. Catch all of your content needs and desires at grumblingsmedia.com. Okay, that's enough of the introductions and the promotions. Let's get right down to it because I guess, guys, a lot of folks on Twitter seem to be intrigued by our subject tonight, so much so that Hody and I got together real quick last night and said, let's entirely change the show. Let's get a guest that's really smart, and let's have it all mixed in a pot and see what comes out. So my guest tonight, co-hosting with me, as always, my good friend and partner, Mr. Hody Johns. Hody, how are you doing tonight?
Better than I deserve? No, I've been a good kid, just as well as I deserve. I'm really happy to be here and really excited to talk about a little nationalism, a little Hopkinism, a little bit of that jazz, especially since now we have we're bringing on an expert, so I can always hobnob with him. So that way, yes, I'll never have the credentials to be able to talk about this stuff. But being able to be in the circles of people who talk about this stuff enabled me to kind of talk out my butt a little bit extra. So I'm excited for that.
Well, Hody, you know, we always want to be the dumbest people in the room, right? Because that's the only way we improve ourselves. And the way we improve ourselves tonight is by introducing our guest. Our guest tonight is Professor Ian J. Scobel. He is a professor of philosophy at Bridgewater State University, where he is also the Bartlett Chair in Free Speech and Expression. And for those of you that have not perhaps caught him on the Big Questions with Big John, he did sit down and do a full biographical interview with me, I'd say about a year or two ago. So go to Grumblings Media and certainly catch the full interview there. Ian, Professor Scobel, how are you doing tonight? Thank you for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here, back with you again. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Glad to have you. Okay, guys, let's get right into it. There was some chatter on Twitter, and this is really just the way these things sort of evolve when you get on these shows. There was a tweet made by someone who is fairly well known in ANCAP circles, in libertarian circles on Twitter, stating something to the effect of that if the LP of Ohio decides to run anyone against Republican Vivek Ramaswamy for governor, the party should be instantly disaffiliated. To which my response, and hence the origins of this show, my response was, LOL, dude calls himself a libertarian nationalist. Which of these two diametrically opposed ideologies does he currently support? Now, Hody, such an innocent little piece of snark for me, but a tidal wave of responses. Let me ask you first, why do you think people are so passionate about my referring to libertarian nationalism as being oxymoronic?
I think there's a little bit of identity politics here. I think that libertarians want to see Vivek succeed. They want to see him be that libertarian who's great, but he is also a very proud nationalist. And so I think this is what happens when we tie our wagons to people instead of principles, is we allow them to pull us in directions where we ordinarily wouldn't go. Nationalism, I can tell you as a Christian who's been growing up, it used to be laughable in Christian circles, and now it's just standard stuff, right? Like your average Christian might consider nationalism. And we see this same thing happening with the Libertarian Party. I think we want a hero. We see Vivek say a couple of libertarian things, and they've been libertarian things when he says them, but he wraps that in nationalism. And we kind of say, like, well, okay, we want to be able to get past this nationalism so that we can kind of get to him. Let's just go ahead and say nationalism's a good thing as a means of supporting him. Yeah, that would be my guess.
Yeah, and to your point, someone like a Seb Gorka says, I'm a Christian nationalist. Like, he actually just has created a new category for himself, Christian nationalist. Ian, tell me, you're someone who I'd like to think has thought about these things a little more deeply than someone like myself. Is the phrase libertarian nationalism akin to something like a vegetarian meat eater? Is it like really that opposite, or are there some nuances there that you can enlighten us or turn us on to?
Well, I don't want to be the sort of professor who comes on with a weaselly answer like, it all depends. But it all depends.
Okay.
The thing is, you know, you use words to signify a particular thing, right? But other people use words differently. So then when I say a thing, I don't necessarily – like if the word becomes used by different people in different ways, then when I use the word, I don't even know if you're hearing the thing I intended to communicate when I say it, right? So some people – so like the word libertarian itself, right? Some people who use that word mean to describe a different set of policy positions than I myself would endorse. So now if I say, well, so I'm a libertarian – if you've been hanging out with that guy, then what you hear when I say that is, oh, so he agrees with that guy. But maybe I don't. So labels are supposed to save time and clear up confusion, but sometimes they actually end up making things worse and causing people not to communicate as well. Having said that as one preface, and then I guess the other thing I want to say by way of preface is, everything that I'm going to say is likely to be contested by somebody. And so, yes, this is my professional area of research, and so I know a little bit about it. But that's not to say that everybody within earshot is going to agree with my take on all these things. Okay, so with those two prefaces put out there, yeah, I think that's pretty oxymoronic. You know, the libertarianism that I studied that, you know, has its origins with Enlightenment figures like Locke and then 19th century Adam Smith and then 19th century figures like John Stuart Mill. And then we see that developed in the 20th century by figures like Mises and Hayek. For all of those people, there's a sort of cosmopolitanism about libertarianism that, you know, the diversity of the human condition is something that's understood as a selling point. Like, this is a good thing. The more we interact with different people, the better off we are, because we can take advantage of other people's knowledge, other people's specializations. And, you know, we have more to work with the more right. We open ourselves up to different sorts of things. Even just from a pure epistemological, sorry, fancy word for theories of knowledge, even from just an epistemological standpoint, entertaining people with different ideas helps us become better thinkers. So even if I don't change my mind from having had a conversation with you, I'm still better off for having had that conversation, because I get to test the ideas that I have against these competing views. So I'm smarter for interacting with people who are not like me, but also I'm typically more prosperous, because the more trading partners I have, you know, the more prosperity we can develop for the both of us. It's a central principle of the liberal tradition that trade is mutually beneficial, right? That the more trades we have, the greater the prosperity for both parties. So the more trades we have, the better off we're going to be. But that's analogous to the epistemological, right? The more conversations we have, the wiser we become about, you know, whatever it is that we were thinking about. And that doesn't mean that you have to change your mind, right? It's right. Just you've thought through what, you know, someone who disagrees with me, what is their view? And even if I don't change my mind, that at least helps me understand my own position that much more clearly. I didn't make that last bit up. That's right out of John Stuart Mill. That's literally his point in why, you know, free speech, freedom of discussion is important for social and intellectual, at the personal level, progress. So, you know, when somebody says, yeah, I think we should just limit freedom to our own local tribe or something like that, well, I mean, in one sense, you don't have any control over other tribes anyway, right? Like, I can't just make Spain become libertarian. Of course, I can't make America become libertarian either, right? All I can do is say, well, look, here's a bunch of principles that would be more likely to produce peace and prosperity. So you can either listen to me or not, right? I can't make anybody do anything. That said, though, the more people who got on board with this, the better off we all be.
Yeah.
The nationalist thing – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to just jump in really quick, because I see what you've described has been my traditional understanding of libertarianism. And the weird thing that, and especially since this libertarian nationalism seems to be coming, and I'm going to slander my good friend Hody here, from the anarchist corner. The ANCAPs, the anarchists, are the ones who are, seem to me, Hody, correct me if I'm wrong, seem to be the ones that are promoting this libertarian nationalism. And because of that, I'm thoroughly confused that even if I gave them the benefit of all virtuous intent, how do you propose to maintain this nationalism, limit immigration, do all this fun stuff if you're an anarchist without coercion, without some form of force, without some form of government, especially on the scale, on a practical scale? Even if you were to say, hey, we want to keep everybody out of New Hampshire, how are you going to do that? You have to have some sort of militia or something, or something coercive and aggressive, in my opinion. Hody, do you, again, you've always said, I'm an anarchist. I've never claimed to be one. Is there any way in your mind an anarchist can say, I believe in nationalism?
No, I think this is purely driven by idolatry. Let's be honest, the person who coined the term anarcho-capitalism became a nationalist, right? Later in life, rejected his own philosophy, right? Murray Rothbard as a liberty and then a post-liberty Rothbard, you know? And so the person who coined that term, who is such an inspiration, who is foundational to that philosophy, ends up becoming a nationalist, right? And then who were his kind of disciples? You have Lou Rockwell, of course, who he worked with, who also went paleo-conservative nationalist. And then you have Hoppe, who, of course, is wildly nationalist, right? All of these people prioritized nationalism over anarchy, right? Like, they all were like, hey, we still like anarchy's maybe our ideal world, but we're okay with ditching that part of our philosophy if it means we get to have this nationalism and this identity. So the unfortunate strike for the anarcho-capitalist, because when I read the capitalists, it's me. It's what I believe. I almost feel like I'm a liar. And Ian, I'll turn this to you a little bit, because I caught your last interview with Big John, and you kind of talk about how language plays a role in how we label ourselves here, right? Like, depending on who I'm talking to, capitalist may be a huge red flag, or like a huge, like, this guy's a good guy. I know in my heart, when I'm reading Friedman, Hayek, Bastiat, Mises, Smith, I know I agree with these guys. And I know we've kind of decided to call those ideas capitalism. At the same time, Big John's absolutely right. This thing has totally been co-opted. Most people who call themselves anarcho-capitalists are people who are extremely bigoted, disreputable, hard to get along with. I guess I'll ask you, Ian, and we've picked your brain about philosophy so much, but I want to get your advice. What does somebody like me call themselves? Or what do we, how do we navigate this in a way that's best for both the philosophy that I actually believe in? Do I just kind of leave it behind? Do I try to redeem the name? What are some factors that you would consider?
Those are all great questions, and unfortunately, I don't have good answers for them. But those are the questions I wrestle with myself. You know, because, you know, people say, well, so, you know, what, like, what are you? Like, I'm supposed to, you know, say Presbyterian or Democrat or whatever. So it's like, I don't even know how to answer those questions anymore. One practical thing, though, is to sort of talk about the policies without the labeling, and get right to. Here's an example that I use in class all the time, right? So in the 1770s, liberals were for global free trade and conservatives were against global free trade. By the 1970s, it was exactly 180 degrees different. It was conservatives who advocated global free trade and liberals didn't like global free trade. By the time we get to today, it's flipped back again. And so is global free trade liberal or conservative? But one way to respond to that question is to say, I don't care. I only care whether it's a good idea or not. Okay. And so, like, I can give an argument for why, like, what are the good things about having global free trade? And if I can convince you that it has these good things, then you should also like it. Then I sort of bypass the part where I call that idea a liberal idea or a conservative idea. And so a lot of times I try to just do that. Without talking about the word libertarian or the word ANCAP or even the word capitalist, for all the reasons that you mentioned, right? Sometimes other people start using words in a way that I don't want them to be associated with, but I don't have any control over that either. But I can talk about the specific policy. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? What are the advantages of this? What are the disadvantages of this? And, you know, if I can get people to think about, you know, are the things that I'm recommending good things? I can do without the labels. But I'm also happy to use labels like when I'm with people who, like, we all know each other sort of thing, then, of course, that can be a time saver. But, you know, if I'm talking to somebody I've never had a conversation with before, maybe it's easier if I don't get into the labeling at all and just talk about here's a policy or here's a value, here's why I think it's good, right, and just have the conversation on that basis.
And let me quickly jump in here and say for those folks that are watching us on the various platforms, just go into your chat. If you have any questions for Dr. Scoble, for Hody or myself, feel free to jump in. Let us know. We'll read your question. We'll try to answer your question as best we can. Hey, we want to hear from both sides. I mean, it may sound like we're totally coming down on the anti-libertarian nationalist side, which, to be fair, I think we are. But at the same time, if someone wants to try to convince us of something that we're not representing, please feel free to do so. So just wanted to throw that in there. But, gentlemen, I did a sort of meta AI collection here, and basically for a definition of libertarian nationalism. Not only that, I said, give me three pros and cons. And I went to different AIs. So if anybody thinks I went to the liberal AI or the woke AI or the conservative, I went through like 12 of them just so people understand. So let me quickly read this. Give me your thoughts. Libertarian nationalism blends libertarian principles of individual liberty, free markets, and limited government with a strong national identity and border security. Proponents argue that a nation state is necessary to preserve individual freedoms within a specific cultural and legal framework, often emphasizing immigration restrictions, national sovereignty, and decentralized governance. Three pros: support strong property rights and economic freedom within national borders, advocates for a government limited in scope but strong in enforcing national security and cultural cohesion, emphasizes self-determination and non-interventionism in foreign affairs. The cons: contradicts open border libertarian ideals by endorsing restrictive immigration, risks leaning into collectivist nationalism, which can infringe on individual rights, can lead to protectionist economic policies that hinder free trade. So it sounds to me like that even the AI is just not even really understanding what this is, because there's a lot of inherent contradiction, even in its own definitions. So, you know, for example, the one line that says proponents argue that a nation state is necessary to preserve individual freedoms, a nation state. But if you talk to these people about minarchy, generally speaking, they think you're not a real libertarian, because it sounds to me like minarchy might better be a description of like a limited state, even if it's just meant to enforce negative rights. But again, libertarian nationalism seems to be pushed or espoused by people who are considered ANCAPs. And I think both of you mentioned this. First of all, before I continue, Hody or Ian, do you have any comments on what I just read about the definition of libertarian nationalism?
Yes, and I don't know if this is a problem with AI or a problem with the so-called libertarian nationalism, but you can't say that we're going to have strong property rights and minimal government and at the same time also have tight border controls. That's literally a contradiction.
Right.
You know, if we think that it's sort of central to classical liberal libertarian tradition that free trade is a good thing. But remember, immigrants are people that counts as commerce. Like, I want to hire this guy to work in my factory. So if you tell me, no, you're not allowed to hire that guy because he was born under a different flag or whatever, then you're actually impeding my ability to run the factory. So there goes the free trade in labor. There goes my property rights as the factory owner. or if I'm someone who, you know, owns an apartment complex, I'm not allowed to rent to that guy because he looks different from me. So there goes my property rights as the owner of the apartment building. So you're telling, it's like, let's leave aside the rights of the migrants, but let's just me for a minute, right? You're telling me I can't hire whoever I want to work for me. You're telling me I can't rent this apartment or sell this house to whoever I make a good deal with to buy the house or rent the apartment. That's a violation of my rights. And, you know, you're interfering with my ability to run the factory the way I want to and to get the kind of labor that I want to get in the factory. And so the idea that, oh, no, we know better than you because those people look different or whatever, so you can't – we don't want them working here. Let's listen to how that sounds. We don't want them working here, right? But I'm the one who's hiring them. So really the only question is, do I want them here? If I'm willing to hire them, that's real – I mean, for libertarianism – that should be the end of the conversation. Do you want to hire this guy? Yeah. Okay. There you go. Where's this third party veto power coming from? That's not consistent with the way libertarian philosophy is supposed to work. I don't have to get some third party approval to hire these people or to sell them my house.
Right. Right. And Hody, I think a lot of people have made this point, for you to even claim a nation involves some sort of collectivism to begin with, right? Like you're saying, there is a United States. There is this concept of the identity of an American that is not just geographical based, right? The people who claim this is like they're not American enough. They don't share our ideals, you know. But again, I find it confusing because, again, that same sort of argument is not applied to, well, why don't we send troops over to defend people who do share our ideals, right? Most libertarians, being anti-foreign interventionalists, would say, hey, even if you did have a libertarian state somewhere, whether it was Israel or not that they are, but I'm just, you know, picking names out of a hat, pick any spot in the world, they would probably tell you we shouldn't be over there. We should not be, you know, and I would tend to agree with that. But then isn't it a logical disconnect to say, but we want to have that here. We want to enforce our beliefs here on others. Do you see that argument, Hody, sometimes? Because I know you go back and forth with a lot of folks that the folks who are saying we want to be pure freedom of association, no imposition of a hierarchy, so on and so forth, yet to Ian's point, we don't want certain people here. We don't think these people align with our beliefs.
Yeah, listen, all people have inherent inconsistencies, right? Like, we all do. Everybody, right? Like, I want to be the best libertarian ever, but I will be apprehensive about some, hey, isn't it great to get rid of, for example, I don't love the fact that we got rid of all the helping the disabled people get an education part of the Department of Education before we got rid of all like the really nasty, hey, here's another $500,000 for a stadium you don't need, you know, subsidies, right? Like, so for like, is that inconsistent? I don't know. I mean, I do want them both gone eventually. I just would have taken down the one before the other, right? So we've all got certain preferences. The trouble that we're having is what we've done is we've taken the preferences of a couple people like Hoppe and said, your inconsistencies, I'm now going to make that part of the philosophy, right? Like we've wrapped his inconsistencies into this philosophy to the point where it's hard to distinguish. And I don't fault him for having inconsistencies. So, well, I mean, I do want him to fix his xenophobia, for example. But at the same time, everybody's got a problem like that. This isn't a problem of purity for me. It's a problem that we are taking the pure philosophy. We are putting his impurity and making that the new philosophy for the ANCAPs.
And that's a great analysis, Hody. I think that's spot on.
Thank you. And actually, I was going to turn it to you for this, especially when we talk about like Hoppe, because the issue that I have is I love multiculturalism. I just finished reading The Fall of Civilizations. And it's not a very – I mean, obviously, there's a lot of politics within the book, but there's not a biased lens in the book. But he was like, one of the things that if we just had to generalize, what do nations do when they're most successful is they're multicultural. And what do they do when they're at their least successful, when they start to fall apart? Usually monolingual, monocultural. It's trying to cut down on that. One of the things that I almost struggle to read Hoppe because of this is they'll talk about the fall of Rome, and they'll be like, yeah, they were really successful and at their height when they're multicultural, but then when they tried to go monocultural, that's when things fell apart. And the lesson he takes from that is that's why we have to stay monocultural, otherwise we'll never, you know, we'll end up when we have to reduce it inevitably down to monoculturalism, we'll fall apart. So we just need to keep it monocultural. I guess, like, to me, it blows my mind because, John, what you were talking about is how much benefit we get from so many different people, people that are nothing like us, right? Like, this is the great part of individualism. Everybody gets to do their own thing, and then we all come together and reap the benefits of all of it. People that are nothing like me, people who I abjectly dislike, people that have personality, I mean, salespeople, lawyers, people that have different personality types than me have great contributions to this amazing world that I live in. And thank goodness they're there. I hope I don't have to talk to them very often, but I'm glad that they're there. Yeah. The attempt to cut them out is kind of what makes things bad. So, Ian, I guess what I wanted to turn to you is, and I've heard so much of your philosophy, and I guess the reason I keep asking you for diagnoses is because I think that's kind of the purpose of philosophy, right? Like, now that I have it, how do I use it? Like,
yeah.
So when I've got this idea of, like, multiculturalism versus monoculturalism, what's the best way to teach people that, like, man, our lives are so much better under the one than the other, that really this nationalism thing, this attempt at monoculturalism has really been pure poison? I tend to go about it like I try to teach them history, but is there a good philosophical way to get to them, or what are some, like, tactics that you have for talking about this?
Actually, I'm sorry, I didn't mean, I want to dive in real quick here, because before Ian answers your question, I just wanted to throw in there two things. First of all, if there's anyone listening to us who is a proponent of Hoppe, please, we want to hear from you, okay? That's the first thing. The second thing is, I have to admit that, and the person's full name, for those that don't know, is Hans Hermann Hoppe, Triple H, like in pro wrestling, right? Hans Hermann Hoppe. When you talk to libertarian nationalists, when you talk to nationalists in general, when you talk to your Jeremy Kaufman types, you know, they will always cite Hoppe to some extent, if not to a large extent, as the grounding or justification for a lot of the positions they hold and a lot of the statements they make, right? And I just wanted to say, like, Hoppe, to my knowledge, is known for two things. One is this sort of xenophobia that you refer to, Hody, you know, that he believes in strong defense of private property. He's a huge critic of democracy in general. And he likes to think of himself as being consistent in his ANCAP worldview. And he's either well-known, famous or infamous, take your pick, for his argumentation ethics position, that by the very nature of you arguing, you are a libertarian, because to not be would be a self-contradiction. I don't know if I believe that necessarily, but that is his one of his major claims to fame. So, having said that, I will now turn it over to Ian and have him answer your question.
Well, you left out the part about homophobia. He also thinks not only should we keep out people from other nations, whatever that means, but also we should be exclusionary towards people who aren't heterosexual. But really, the objection to one and the objection to the, like, those are both wrong in my view for the same reason. What you're doing is cutting yourself off from things that might actually help you, that could be beneficial to you personally or to the society at large. So, you know, here's one way to approach this. You guys like pizza?
Yes. Love it.
Yeah, me too. So isn't that something that comes from another culture? It's from another culture, yet it's considered to be a sort of typical American thing, but obviously that's not true of its origin. So what's the story there? The story is that we accept things from other cultures And if they're real popular, they get assimilated. And then the next thing you know, nobody even remembers that it's multicultural. They just think, oh, you know, I want some good American food like pizza. And of course, that's ridiculous. I guess the only thing that would really be American food would be like whatever the Native Americans were eating before 1492. But when most people talk about, oh, I just want some American food, they don't mean anything, you know, like squash and whatever. They mean, you know, pizza or Chinese food. It's right there in the name, Chinese food, right? That's from a different culture. But one of the cool things about free society is that we can take whatever comes our way, and anything that's good, we keep it. Anything we don't like, we don't find use for that. But also, people are different. Like, maybe you don't like Chinese food, but this guy does like Chinese food. But in a free society, you know, you can eat Chinese food if that's what you like, and this guy can avoid the Chinese restaurant if he doesn't care for it. But if you make these blanket claims, like we're not going to let any people from China come to this country, or we don't want anybody from Venezuela coming to this country, or we should get rid of all the people who aren't heterosexual, you know, that's so obviously inconsistent with what a free society is about that it's sort of hard, like it's hard to understand why you have to keep explaining that point to people. And there's two dimensions to it, right? One is, you know, maybe there's some violation of that person's rights, but minimally there's a violation of my rights. I like Chinese food. I like eating pizza. So the more you say, we don't want any of those foreigners coming in, that means fewer choices for me. Fewer, not just in terms of restaurant choices, but also like fewer neurosurgeons. Like maybe the person who's going to cure cancer is coming out of, medical school in another country. Okay, so you say, we can't have those people coming here. I don't know, maybe I want as many geniuses emigrating here as possible, right? So it's not just about, you know, making sure I have lots of dinner choices. It's also about making sure that we have engineers and neuroscientists and whatever who are going to contribute things of tangible value to the rest of the society.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many layers to this. Like you said, Ian, it's not just food. Food is the easy example we can all use, but there's a lot of things, and they manifest themselves in different ways. Like a lot of the clapback you get from these white libertarian nationalists, I'm sorry, I almost slipped there, is a lot of, let's face it, flat out racial stuff, stereotypes, white nationalist stuff. Like in that very thread I mentioned at the top of the show. I'm not saying all of them, but you do see this. Someone tweeted me a map of the world where each country was labeled with the average IQ score and said libertarian nationalism means that we don't accept anybody who from a country whose average IQ score is less than ours. Somebody else tried to justify it, some sort of weird eugenics based to justify libertarian nationalism, or vice versa. Libertarian nationalism justifies some sort of eugenics. And as a matter of fact, one of the guys from, I think, LP Allies, Phil, who do you might know? Philip Rain? Is that how you pronounce his name? Rain? No. I'm not sure. It's R-E-I-G-N. Anyway, he's a follower. Shout out to him. And he basically clapped the guy down. And, you know, again, as a old biologist myself, you know, the truism was in nature, what kind of organisms tend to survive evolutionarily? It's the hybrids. It's never the hybrid organisms tend to survive because they encompass more diverse traits that better equips them to survive. So even on a biological level, it doesn't work. And then the final thing I'll say about this matter is the not paying attention to history. In this country, it seems like every 25 or 30 years, fellas, we go through this cycle of here's the new immigrant group that we hate. Here's the new immigrant group that we feel as nativists are not contributing to what we view to be our preferred culture in this country. Started with the Know Nothing Party in the 1800s. At first it was anti-German sentiment, anti-Irish sentiment, anti-Japanese, anti-Chinese on the West Coast. I mean, I don't have to go through it all. We know what it is, right? And, sure. And now we're at this stage. So, yeah, very passionate about it to say that this is nonsense. But it seems like HOPA has become the justification for this. Hody, like, how many times have you heard, like, when someone you're debating someone on this issue and the appeal to authority always goes back to HOPA?
Yeah, he's better than Jesus for these guys. I mean, he's the Bible for him. And it's unfortunate, like I said. And the reason HOPA gets pointed out is because you're not going to find it as a natural extension of the philosophy of liberty, right? Like, you need HOPA to make this point for you because nobody is going to make this point, right? Like, yeah, no libertarian.
That's a great point. Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Hody. It's like if you listed like 30 other works from the tradition, you wouldn't find those positions in any of them. So people who are inclined to want to make that argument only have one thing that they could point to.
Right. Yeah, it's that's how I feel about it. But like I want to like try to disengage my feelings as much as possible because I understand like there's some – people are allowed to feel how they feel, and I understand, like, listen, there is, like, cultures do collide and clash, but we are better off having those clashes and having those collisions than we would be abandoning them, you know, just saying, like, oh, forget it, you know, like, I think that, to me, that's the point that I always try to make, is that libertarians, we get accused of believing in utopianism a lot, but we are not utopians. Right? Like, we accept that there's a lot of problems in this universe. We just want the solution of those to come from something other than the state, come from something other than government. And that's a pretty basic, you know, thing for libertarians, or at least it used to be. We're just kind of in an awkward stage right now. And Ian, this is what I was going to ask you, based on your history. And I am a very white-pilled libertarian, as they say. I see the best. I believe we will win in the end. Hoorah. I'm very excited about all that. But I also read things like The Guarded Gate, and I'm like, here's how immigration's control started. And it started with eugenicists. It started with straight genocidal maniacs. You know, it started with all these bad things, and yet we never shook them. And so I worry because, of course, if we're not shaking, you know, these problems, are we ever going to get better from them? And so, especially since you have kind of looked into the history and you have seen what happens to these philosophies, what are our growing pains going to look like as libertarians when we have an infection like this? Is this something we're going to end up working out eventually? Is it just one of those that's going to take a couple hundred years like slavery? Or is this something that, hey, this is libertarianism now, and hopefully it gets better.
Yeah, I don't mean to weasel out of your question, but I'm really bad at predicting the future, and I don't have any basis for picking one or the other of those two things. I mean, excuse me. The tendency for people to be fearful of outsiders, I mean, that's probably pretty commonplace. So the question is, like, what sorts of institutions might work against our natural inclination to be that way? And one of those is, you know, the more cosmopolitan the society is, the easier it is to be cosmopolitan because you're used to that. And maybe that's why, you know, like, people who grow up in New York City are a little more relaxed about multiculturalism than, say, people from more homogenous parts of the country where they just have less exposure to different things in the first place. But, you know, we also live in an age of mass media. So even if you live in, like, Idaho or whatever, you watch TV, and so you would see this changing landscape on a screen, even if you don't see it in real life. And I suppose one reaction to that would be, I hate this. I'm fearful of this. This makes me uncomfortable. I don't know, but then, like, what's the reason why you're fearful of this? What's the reason that that makes you uncomfortable? And I don't know if you can really give a good reason why it should bother you. And, you know, if something bothers you, but you can't give a good reason why it bothers you, maybe it shouldn't bother you. And so, you know, things like that, you know, even if it, you know, it's like, even if we understand psychologically what people might have a particular reaction, we're also perfectly capable of saying, well, that's really, you shouldn't have that kind of reaction. That's something like the things you're afraid of are nothing to be afraid of. And the more you get to know people who are different from you, the more you come to see, right, I don't have anything to be afraid of here. Maybe I was being silly. Maybe I was overreacting. So, you know, it's like this is why one reason why I like it when kids go to college, because they go to college and they meet people that they didn't grow up with. Like all the way through high school, it's like, yeah, these are the same people I've been hanging out with for the last 17 years. You go to college, you're going to meet new people now. Even if it's a, you know, only a regional school, they're not from your hometown. They'll be from other parts of the state. And so that's your first chance to, you know, get out of that bubble and meet people who are not exactly the same people that you've been hanging out with for the previous 17 years. And, you know, if you can survive that, then maybe you can survive an hour in Times Square. You know, it's like, I don't know. People have impulses which are not always, you know, the right ones that people should have. People, you know, people have ignorances, prejudices, things of this nature. That people have those views, though, is not anything that necessarily, like, if you discover, yeah, I actually was making some judgment about this person, all right, maybe I shouldn't have had that attitude in the first place. People can change. People can get better.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And one of the things I also wanted to go through tonight is I don't want to get the sense that we're picking only on the libertarian nationalists, because there's equal opportunity to pick on a lot of different things. So I just want to pivot a little bit at this point, because I think we've pretty much established where we stand on libertarian nationalism. But I just wanted to generally toss out and let you guys comment about some of the things here. I love throwing out this name dropping, but I remember interviewing Walter Block. And when I asked him, I said, why do we have, you know, how many different types of libertarians are there? You know, and Ian, to your point, I expected a professorial weaseling at that point. You know, well, let me tell you a little bit, you know, but he actually said four. There's four categories. He gave me a nice number that I could go by being an analyst. Right. And he said, there's anarchy, there's binarchy, there's constitutionalism, and there's classical liberalism. And, of course, he gave me examples of each category, like proponents that we would know of. And to be honest with you, after that interview, I kind of thought about it, and I said, you know, I think I could live with that sort of classification, that categorization, because I think it kind of encompasses everything. Because, one, you know, if anarchy is 100% libertarian, then the lowest you get to with classical liberalism might be 80%. And you start at that level and you work your way towards the end goal, right? Which, you know, none of us will live to see. But we're also inundated, especially when it comes to the political applications of libertarianism, we're inundated with a lot of different terms. We talked about ANCAPs, agorists, agorists, right libertarians, left libertarians, anarcho-communists, which, again, certain things don't immediately register with me, and our libertarian socialists. I've heard that one bandied about recently. And I don't know how you guys think about it. I always think about it that if you start with the noun being libertarianism, what do those other adjectives do for libertarianism? What's missing from libertarianism that the other adjective is supposed to provide? That's my sort of like litmus test. If you can explain to me what's missing, like, for example, when I say I'm a minarchist and the people say, well, why are you a minarchist and not an anarchist? My answer is very standard. I can't force everyone else in the world to also be an anarchist. So until that point, I prefer to be a minarchist, right? And I kind of leave it. That's my classification, right? But I'm not antithetical to anarchy, right? So let me throw some terms out at you. Right libertarian. What does the right part of right libertarian inject into libertarianism that isn't there to begin with?
I'm with you on this. I've often wondered that same thing. When I have friends who make this distinction. No, I'm a left libertarian. No, that's right libertarian, and I don't quite get it. Best I can figure out is a lot of people who want to go with the label left libertarian think that the structure of the corporation that we're familiar with couldn't possibly exist without the state to make it happen. And so there's some sort of objection to like some of the way that business takes shape. And so and they would characterize as right libertarians, the one who think that we should have maximal freedom, but the current structure of our business community is whatever it is. So, and there's an empirical question there. Would you get the same exact economic structure if we didn't have any government intervention whatsoever? And the answer is, I'm sure it would be a little different, right? I don't think it's obvious that you would get nothing like a publicly traded corporation without the government. So the fact that the government actually runs the laws and the legal structure about incorporation, that doesn't imply that without any government, nobody would form that kind of a business association. So if that's what's driving it, I think they're overstating the case a little bit. Other things that the left and right are doing in those hyphenated labels are signaling something about other sympathies they might have. So maybe a right libertarian is somebody that you might think is more interested in, business deregulation, whereas a left libertarian might be more interested in same-sex marriage or sex worker liberation or something like this. But again, you made this point, and I think correctly, that if you're actually taking the libertarian part of that seriously, then the modifier left or right isn't actually adding anything to the conversation. You either believe that people should be free to do whatever they want to do that doesn't harm other people, or you don't think that.
Right.
There's something like 90% of libertarians are first generation, right? And I think what this is when we look at like the Israelites out in the desert, they are having to shed themselves of a lot of bad practices and bad customs and bad verbiage and bad words. And they need to kind of take on and learn a whole different set of life. And I think the presence of terms like left libertarian, right libertarian, anarcho-socialist, anarcho-capitalist, whatever, is simply like we're so used to talking about liberty. We're so used to viewing politics through a left and left versus right lens, the Democrats versus Republicans. And we all come from that, right? Like there's no sense in denying that. And so many of us just say like, oh, I'm right libertarian means I should be more libertarian. But sometimes if I fall off to the minarchist side one way or the other, I fall off towards the Republican side. Whereas the left libertarians kind of fall off towards the Democrat side. It's just kind of I think it's more social than it would be like philosophical very often. And in fact, right. I would say I am almost living proof of this because I have friends. I just came right before this from like a socialist book club, and I have like a classical liberal book club tomorrow. I'm the same guy in both groups. I get along with both of them just fine. They both think I'm one of them, but it's simply because we kind of stick to, I believe in everybody's rights all the time. I believe in the socials and the economic freedoms. I don't favor one or the other. And I think the more we kind of get to that and stop letting ourselves be divided by our past, letting ourselves be like, we need to stop thinking like I'm a Republican and or a Democrat who became a libertarian, but I'm living in this Republican Democrat world. I think the first start and first step in being recognized as a third party is recognizing it within ourselves, right? Like as opposed to saying, oh, well, socially I'm with you guys, economically I'm with you guys.
Oh, we can't do that.
Advertise ourselves as different animals, right? Yeah. This is a totally different way of life. Christianity was not like a Buddhist Taoist fusion mix, right? Like it's its own thing, Yeah.
No, I think that's perfectly well said. I agree entirely that it's not this thing or that thing. It's some distinct third thing. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it makes sense because on a very I'm sorry, we have a comment. Let me bring it up here. William says, seems pretty clear to me. A Joshua Echol is a left libertarian, and a current Mises guy like Dave Smith is a right libertarian. That's because you get the unhappy Republican or Democrat. You all are like Dorothy, picking up stragglers who are lost along the way, trying to build a party. Yeah, that's probably right from the – that's probably correct, rather, I should say, from the political sense that being a third party – and thank you, William – being a third party right now, yeah, you have to fight for space. You have to fight a marketing campaign, whether you position yourself as a contrarian party, whether you can you appeal to the high-minded, whether you appeal to the frustrated. We've seen it on a very practical level, right? That's how Trump has such a supportive base in seemingly contradictory terms, right? He's a Republican, but he's anti-free trade. He's, you know, he's a Republican who wants to take your guns first and ask questions later. And yet everybody in his coalition consistently loves him because he didn't tap into left or right. He tapped into I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. That's what he actually has tapped into, right?
Right. But notice what's interesting about that is he didn't do it through a third party movement. He did it by co-opting one of the two existing parties. One of the things that my friends over in the political science department have made very clear to me is that if you have a system with first past the post voting, then you're going to get a two-party system. And third parties really can't get off the ground because what they end up doing is siphoning votes away from whatever you think is the closest to you.
Right.
They actually lose votes as you vote third party. So the only way, if you actually want a third party to get off the ground, is to have, you know, like a different voting system, maybe proportional representation or some kind of parliamentary system or maybe ranked choice voting, some kind of structural change in the way we do our elections. Otherwise, it's always going to be a two-party system, which can change if somebody gets into one of the two main parties and then sort of co-opts that. And that's how, that's how, like, if you took like Ronald Reagan in a time machine to today and said, hey, Ron, here's what Republicans are about today, he'd lose his mind. He wouldn't find this recognizable at all.
Right.
You know, I'm fond of watching one of the debates during the Republican primary in 1980 with older Bush and Reagan arguing about which of them was more pro-immigration than the other.
Yes. Right? Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
I love that. But then, like, if you beam those guys up in a time machine today and said, here's the GOP now, they would have no conception of how things got that way. But it's not because you made a third party. It's because you were able to capture one of the two existing parties. So that's how you get Trumpian populism. So how do we get classical liberal or libertarian thing? Unfortunately, the history of the LP is a good one, but they've made some weird choices. But in any event, like whether they've made good choices or bad choices, it's not going to happen, right? Because that's just the way poli-sci tells us these things happen. Unless you change the voting system, we're stuck with the two-party system. So probably a better way to advance liberty would be to work to get one or the other parties to take liberty more seriously. I don't see that. Like in the 80s, a lot of libertarians thought, yeah, the Republicans are the way to go with that. But I think today that's not even remotely close to true, which doesn't mean, of course, that the Democratic Party is either. What has to happen now, I think, from our point of view, is a sort of a wait-and-see sort of thing, right? What are the Democrats going to do? Because one thing we know the Democrats want to do is get power back from the Republicans. So how are they going to do that? So one way that they could do that is sort of double down on the sorts of things that led to Trump getting elected in the first place, Or the other thing that they might do is say, well, maybe we need a different approach. And it's possible, just possible, that that different approach might be something that, you know, we would understand as, you know, more liberty friendly. I don't know. I'm totally speculating here. But, I am familiar with the poli-sci literature on how third parties don't work in a first-past-the-post electoral system.
That's a great point, because we do get caught up in that. And let's, to your point, we've tried it before. Hody loves saying, like, every time the Libertarian Party has tried to do that, to ingratiate itself with the Republicans, mainly, as you said, it's always, you know, great, thank you for your votes this time around, and then you're discarded. And it's always been the hardcore folks who stick to their principles where we see change come, whether it was gay marriage or marijuana legalization or, you know, things of that nature. And it's a shame to me. But let me take a half step back. Last question of the evening. Tell me your thoughts about this. All three of us here like to consider ourselves as libertarians. Where do you personally draw the line to when you say we're to judge, if that's in your nature, or if you were to describe someone who is not libertarian? I'm playing off the old joke that if the three of us were at a dinner party, by the end of the night, all three of us would accuse the other two of not being real libertarians. So if we were to say, what's our bright red line in the sand? What's our red line in the sand when it comes to what disqualifies someone from calling themselves libertarian? Perfect example, again, the person that started this whole kerfuffle this week, Vivek Ramaswamy. For example, Ian, would you consider Vivek to be a libertarian?
I'm honestly not as familiar with all of his positions as I probably should be to answer that question. But, okay. I mean, in general, purity test approaches tend to not be that helpful. But if you're specifically advocating policies that are rights violative, then you're not a libertarian. I mean, if it means anything at all, it means that you have to take individual rights as seriously as you possibly can. And so if you're saying something like, well, you're not allowed to hire this person to work in your factory, that's anti-libertarian. If you're saying you're not allowed to marry that person because I don't approve, that's anti-libertarian. So I don't know exactly what this guy's policy positions are, but if they're using the state to violate people's rights, that's anti-libertarian.
I mean, it's, fair enough.
In a way, it's like this really complicated philosophy stuff, got a PhD and whatever. But on the other hand, it's also like really simple.
Right.
Are you using force to violate somebody else's rights, or are you letting people do whatever they want to do, subject only to the condition that it doesn't violate other people's equal right to do the same things that they want to do?
Sounds pretty simple.
With that definition, it's pretty tough to get anybody to be a libertarian unless they're like pretty anarchist, which is what I always think the worry is. But I'm gonna throw this by you, Ian, and you've been very gracious in saying I've been giving a lot of right answers, which I'm gonna crop them all and take it to the bank with me if you don't mind. But I'm gonna go ahead and say something that I think maybe you'll disagree with. Because you're big on principles and you're big on philosophy. And I think what I would end up saying is a lot of this comes down to character. Because I think that you can have somebody who says all the right things and has all the right positions, but they're a liar. And I don't think that that makes you a libertarian. And you might say, like, well, I espouse those values, but you actually didn't. You espoused selfishness and you were able to abandon those values, as many of them do, when you have bad character, that ultimately there comes a point where we kind of have to consider who the person is. The thing is ultimately, John, you and I, you're a minarchist and I'm an anarchist, but we get along just fine because ultimately, John, here's the thing. And I'll explain this why I got along with like Chase Oliver, for example, like in his positions. I am open borders. He is, let's have a good, well-managed border system where we're not abusing people. Well,
Ellis
I think
Island
both those.
Guy. Yeah. Right. An Ellis Island guy. Yeah.
Right. And now I still disagree with that position because ultimately, you know, if I may be so crass, I think government is ultimately like a bunch of goons and pedophiles and rapists. like they're terrible, whatever. Right? Yeah. I don't think there's any fixing them, right? Like, I don't think there's any making them better. However, if you're trying to make them better and you're actually holding their feet to the fire, I hope you succeed. I hope you win, right? Like, I want you to ultimately try. And that makes you on my team in the end, right? Like, I'm saying ultimately a lot because that's what I'm saying is in the end, I think we're on the same team, even though we might espouse different values. I think a lot of libertarians say, oh, we're on the same road, and then 5 miles away, you'll exit. I don't even see that. I think eventually you'll get to a society that's full of so much, like, love and compassion that whether you want to call it government or not, we're just kind of like, well, no, that's just a really, that's a good dude who knows a lot about that subject and he's trying to help out. Right. Like, and we don't really have a word for that. So is there, Ian, and you know, I want to turn it to you for kind of the last words on this, because obviously this is, you're the one who knows better. Does character play anything when it comes to philosophy, or like, am I just like way off base?
Oh, no, I agree with you entirely. I mean, it's your fundamental moral principles have to come first. I mean, I can say whatever, but if I'm a liar or a cheat, then whatever I said, it doesn't matter because I'm a liar or a cheater, right? So I think integrity is important. I think it's important to have, you know, the virtues of character that make you a good person. Integrity is beyond that list there. But I think there's a connection too, right? Because how you, like, if you think it's important, so like, what I get annoyed with is people who talk the libertarian line, but when you scratch the surface, it ends up that's like, I'm just interested in protecting my own liberty, but I don't really care about liberty of the other guy. Okay, but that reveals, I think, what you're characterizing as a character flaw, right? Because I'm like making a special exception for myself, like putting myself above everybody else. But if I actually, have some integrity and see myself as a human like other humans, not any worse, but also not any better than other humans, then I'm sort of obliged to see that the same kind of protection of my rights, my autonomy that I would insist on for myself has to apply to other people. And my inability to recognize that, that's not just getting political philosophy wrong. That's an ethical problem. That's a character flaw, I think.
Right. It's kind of like the golden rule. Like, if you practice it to its fullest extent, that's going to change your political philosophy at some point as well, right?
I think,
like,
that's true, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Sweet.
That's interesting, yeah. And the thing I want to sort of, exchange you two had just there, because I've always maintained that character does matter. Hody knows that about me, and I've always said, like, character is how we can expect you to perform when no one's watching. Character is the thing that lets me know that if you do get elected into office, you're going to do the right thing when you have a situation that hasn't been scripted for you. You know, that when life throws that curveball and the chips are down, how are you going to react? And I think character is what defines that. Yeah, there's training and stuff like that, but character is really, I think, the reason why. And if I can't trust your character, there's nothing you could tell me. Again, not to personalize this. I know some people hate me, but that's the reason, as a native New Yorker for almost 60 years, I would never cast a vote for Donald Trump if he were to become the second coming of Milton Friedman, John Locke, or Adam Smith, because in terms of policy, simply because I do not trust his character. And I've said that. And I know some people say, I don't care what his character is, as long as he delivers on his promises, which, fair enough, that might be your standard, that he's not a liar or he's consistent or whatever. But for me, to your point, Hody, to your point, Ian, it's all about the character. I'd rather have someone like Gary Johnson tell me, what was that? What is Aleppo? Oh, well, I think we shouldn't intervene. Wherever Aleppo is, I don't think we should intervene. It's none of our business. That, to me, is a person with character who just needs to learn about geopolitics more, as opposed to someone who, you know, will say, I won't intervene, and the next thing you know, we're droning Mexican drug cartels, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So to me, that's, and I think that's a great point both of you made, and I think that's a great way to end the show. So on that note,
okay.
I want to say thank you to our guest for the evening, Professor Ian Scoble. He's the professor of philosophy at Bridgewater State University and also the Bartlett Chair in Free Speech and Expression. Ian, thank you so much. Is there a book you want folks to know about that they can read, perhaps, that you've authored?
I'm working on some right now, but neither of them is out just yet. But in the meantime, I think, you know, if people would read, I'm a big fan of Deirdre McCloskey's book, Bourgeois Virtues. I'm a big fan of Nozick's book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. I'm a big fan of Rasmussen and Denial's books, Norms of Liberty. If people read those, I think they would really learn a lot. And especially about the connection between all three of those, play up the sort of morality, political philosophy connections that we were getting into at the last minute there.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you. Hode Man, tell the people what you've been up to.
Oh, hey, everybody. Same old, same old. You know, I live such a good life that anything new would probably be bad. So same old is great news for me. I am still with the Love First Christian. So those of you who are in more of like a theological interest, go ahead and follow me. I'm at the Hode Man on Twitter. You can find me at Hody Johns over on Facebook. I have links all over the place to find the Love First Christians. It's just a free Discord group. We're going through the whole Bible in 1 year. We've got some people who have been like bishops for 20 plus years. And we got some people who are like Christians. Some are perspective. Some are not perspective Christians. Some just like are interested in these conversations. And it's created a gamut of like personality types as we've studied this. And it's been fantastic. So if you're interested in going through that Bible for the first time, we're only like 16% of the way through. You can still play catch up. Talk about current events, talk about our lives. Of course, we talked about metal music and if the Virgin Mary had original sin last week. So ton of great conversations there if you're interested in the religious side. But that's what I've been doing. How about you, Big John? What have you been doing?
Well, first of all, I was going to say you're a little bit shy because, of course, what Hody didn't tell you is he kind of crossed over to the dark side and he went and he got on my conservative partner's show, The Red, White, and Rude, to talk gaming. So go to grumblingsmedia.com, look up Hody's appearance on Red, White, and Rude. That was a fantastic appearance. I know William appreciated it. I hope Hody did as well. Me, I'm Big John. You can catch me every Thursday night here with Hody for Free For All. Also, catch Liberty Lens with my co-host, Mike Termont, former vice presidential candidate Mike Termont, as we tackle just one issue of interest to libertarians every week. Until next time, join us again right here on Free For All. Peace, everyone.